facts. About two-thirds of poor children reside in single-parent homes. Poor mothers who married before their baby was 6 months old were half as likely to be raising the child in poverty 5 years later. Married men drink less, take drugs at a lower rate, and earn between 10 and 40% more than single men with similar resumes. 92% of children who live in families that make more than $75,000 a year live with two parents. 80% of those who make less than $15,000 do not. Kids who don't live with two biological parents are more than five times as likely to be poor and twice as likely to drop out of high school and have problems with their behavior. Those who marry and never divorce end up more than four times richer than those who never marry. What does it all mean? Number crunchers say that if the nuclear family hadn't collapsed as it had in the last generation, the poverty rate would be 26% lower for white children and 38% lower for black children. Another estimate found that if poor mothers married their children's dads, almost three-quarters would immediately be lifted out of poverty. Not only is this an inarguable case for anyone encouraging marriage in society, but it's a good bullet point list to have handy for that hesitant girlfriend you just proposed to on the big screen at the baseball game. Just as important, we have got to stop telling people that they can't do it. I've come to realize that one of the main keys to success in a capitalist system is to simply believe in it. In other words, if you want to beat them, join them. When you think success is possible, you spend more time thinking about how to achieve it and less time complaining about all of the system's imperfections. If you can't find a way to embrace our system instead of whining like a toddler who wants an animal cracker, try renting an apartment in China for a couple of years. They have a much different system there, and perhaps you'll flourish in it there by the rice paddy. Although my guess is you'll be back on Air Beijing in about a week begging for the unjust American lifestyle that you now hold in such disdain. We've also got to stop giving out 14th place trophies. For whatever reason, we've adopted the idea that the best thing we can do for our kids is to remove all conflict and struggle from their lives. We're so concerned with people's feelings that we shield them from something I like to call the truth. When you finish 14th, you don't deserve a trophy. What you do deserve and what you need is a lesson in how the real world works. When you don't perform, you get nothing. The phrase is, to the victor goes the spoils, not spoil those who aren't the victor. If we continue to shelter our kids the way we do, we're going to have a generation of adults who can't handle the financial, emotional, and political struggles of everyday life. That's the struggle that makes us strong. If we understand up front that everything isn't going to be handed to us, that struggle becomes a blessing. Many of the greatest people in history had a bad lot in life, and most of them were great because of that lot. Do I need to remind you that Jesus was born in a manger? Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to go play some squash over at John Edwards' house. Section 7. Choosing a movie. With all the serious problems facing the world these days, it might seem like a waste of valuable time to talk about something as trivial as how to agree on a movie to watch, but as you shall soon see, picking the right movie directly affects the future of the human race. Go with me for a second. Here's what Hollywood needs to realize. Movies are an escape. Life stinks sometimes. At some point, everybody on the planet has to suffer through some crappy job, a bad marriage, or a Hillary Clinton speech. An escape for pathetic married men like me that we hope leads to sex. Please? But believe me, Nobody's escaping anything after watching Al Gore give a 2-hour global warming slideshow. It's a well-known fact that any movie featuring footage of melting glaciers is a guaranteed nookie killer. But glaciers aren't alone. There are plenty of other things that Hollywood should ban based solely on their ability to prevent me from sealing the deal. For instance, movies that feature cancer-stricken mothers. Stepmom, The Family Stone. Nobody's getting lucky after that movie. Or movies that feature messages. Crash. Happy Feet. Movies that feature George Clooney also aren't helpful. There's no way any woman is going to be in the mood when she's going home with someone who looks like George Peppard after watching 2 hours of George Clooney. The common denominator among these films is obvious. They all make my wife cry and fall asleep. That in turn means no sex, which makes me cry myself to sleep. What the Hollywood pinheads don't realize is that preventing dudes from having their weekly, 8 minutes... All right, 5 minutes. Oh, come on. All right, 3 minutes of bliss with their wives. Okay, all right, 2 minutes. Makes them directly responsible for the extinction of the human race. It's all explained in a very simple Glenn Beck equation. Crappy movies equals no sex equals no babies equals the end of mankind. Okay, so choosing the right movie is important, right? But where do you start? First thing you got to consider, timing. On a Tuesday night, when your wife is in a bad mood because you didn't take out the garbage again, hypothetically, of course, there's virtually no chance of sealing the deal. Go nuts. Choose a nice James Bond movie, or if you're feeling particularly risque, go for anything featuring the three L's, ladies, lasers, and more lasers. I call these simply laser movies for short. Friday night, however, is a whole new ball game. It's no longer about chores you didn't do. It's about scoring. Gentlemen, you know as well as I do what that means. You gotta do or see whatever it takes. Unfortunately, whatever it takes is almost always the dreaded Bonnet movie. If laser movies are our meat and potatoes, the food we'd live on if no one harassed us about our diet, then Bonnet movies are like spinach and broccoli. We only watch them when we're forced to.
The actual definition of a Bonnet movie is very scientific. I've been refining it for years, but I will summarize it for you.
Bonnet movie. Noun. 1. Any film based on the work of Jane Austen. 2. Generally any movie featuring either Emma Thompson or Kate Winslet in a lead role. 3. Any movie that is muddy, pale, and difficult to understand, kind of like Mickey Rourke. 4. Any movie that features horses, English manor houses, and or effeminate men with fluffy collars. Of course, no matter the actors, the key feature of all of these movies is that virtually everyone is inexplicably wearing a bonnet. Bonnet movies, frankly, are about as sexy as gum disease, which is a pretty apt comparison since they almost always take place in 18th century or 19th century Great Britain. They weren't too big on dental hygiene back then. Or, come to think of it, ever. I should look into that. The point is that for some absolutely insane reason that men are not ever meant to understand, chicks dig bonnet movies, and that is why, if it means increasing my odds of having sex, I'd not only take my wife to see a frickin' bonnet movie, I'd wear a bonnet. I'd put in fake British teeth that are all bleeding in the gums and speak in an English accent and read really bad poetry to her in the meadow as she calls me, "Oh, Mr. Darcy. Oh, Mr. Darcy, I love you so." Mercifully, I don't have to do any of that. I can just take her to see a little woman's room with the remains of the end of Howard's Prejudice or whatever that crap she wants me to watch. I'll buy us a tub of popcorn, large, extra butter, and a pack of goobers. Okay, 2 packs. And I'll reap the benefits, my friends. If you're already in a relationship, you're gonna have to suck it up and realize that a large percentage of your movie-going time Going to be spent watching bonnet movies. Oh, yes, that's what marriage is all about. But not all relationships are the same. A budding new romance is a far cry from a 25-year marriage. Since this can get pretty confusing, let me illustrate the differences with a series of easy-to-understand ratios. You're dating for 6 months or less. 5 bonnet movies for every 1 laser movie. Sounds horrible, yeah. But keep in mind, you're still trying to convince her that you're a sweet, sensitive guy. You know, the kind that chicks want. If you really want to go the extra mile, watch your 1 laser movie allotment in private. You know, a bathroom or at work. That way, she'll think you're only interested in the bonnets. It's a great scam. Engaged. Rules? 3 bonnet movies for every 1 laser movie. Still, not great, but we are making progress, men. Remember, you're trying to get her to actually go through with the wedding at this point. Of course, if you don't want to go through with the wedding, then a guy's weekend featuring 48 episodes of 24. You know what I'm saying? That'll do the trick, baby. Married less than 5 years. 1 bonnet movie for every 1 laser movie. All right, now we're getting someplace. You could technically eliminate the bonnet movies altogether at this stage, but you don't want to make it look as if you changed the second you got married, even though that's exactly what happened. Married more than 5 years. Yeah, this is where it gets good. No more bonnet movies. Yeah, congratulations. You've finally reached the promised land. Oh, take a load off, Moses. Most likely, you're not getting lucky anymore. So why bother risking the hell of a bonnet movie just for the off chance that hell will freeze over? Odds are about the same as for a big Powerball win, but instead of just risking a dollar, you're risking an entire night with Emma Thompson. Next on the scale, married with children. No more movies, period. You got kids, man. Both the bonnet movie and the laser movie give way to something far more insidious and quite frankly creepy. The talking animal movie. I'll cover how we get out of those in the next book. After years of experience, I can unequivocally tell you that the only way to stomach a bonnet movie is to rent it. Sure, the theater offers all of those delicious treats, but it also offers public displays of crying women, lots and lots of crying women, and comatose husbands all pathetically trying to look interested while thinking, yes, yes, Lady Buttercherne loves Mr. Winterbottom, who loves Countess Thornwhistle, big manor house, horses. Good God, man, when does this end? Persuading her to rent the movie instead is a big advantage for a couple of reasons. First, since your home is likely the place where the coveted sex would happen, just being in your home is already a first great step. Second, if you play your cards just right, you may get lucky without even having to watch the movie. And here's how that works. 1, make sure the room you'll be watching the movie in, very, very dark. Quiet, too. Shh. 2, if you followed number 1 closely, then it's almost a guarantee that she'll be asleep within 10 minutes, or by Emma Thompson's first appearance, whichever comes first. Once that happens, a small window of hope opens up, but you've got to act fast. 3, extract yourself from whatever crazy, tangled position she's put herself in, usually the one that's most comfortable for her, but allows you no use of your arms or hands, and get up from the couch. For inspiration, think back to when you were 14 and you'd slowly try to get your arm around the girl next to you at the movies. Well, do the same thing, just in reverse. That's really the only difference between being an awkward teen and an awkward husband. Everything is just backwards now. But be careful. Like a game of Operation, if you wake her up, you lose. And this game doesn't feature buzzers, it features bonnets. 3 to 5 hours of bonnets. 4, eject the bonnet movie and put in the laser movie. But before you do anything, lower the volume. Or, dare I say it, splurge. Use headphones. 5, when the laser movie is over, gently wake up your wife and say, oh man, that was good. She'll, of course, say, oh, he was. And you say, oh, that was insert the name of the Bonnet movie here, really beautiful. For added points, pretend to wipe away a tear from your eye. If you're successful, you will get credit for a Bonnet movie that you never saw because you saw the laser movie. 6. Cash in your points. If your wife is too tired after the movie, a common occurrence, then make sure you remind her of your sacrifice the next night as you put in your pitch for some action. If she's still too tired,
or, "I'm just feeling so bloated,"
or,
"I gotta get up so early,"
or,
"My big toe hurts,"
then save your points. They never, ever expire. At a minimum, you can cash them in for a laser movie some other night, or escape some mundane chore. In fact, I have an idea that is so simple, yet so revolutionary, that I believe it could literally change the way men and women rent movies together. If I wasn't already a little busy at work, honestly, I'd start a company around this idea, but since I can't, I'm offering it to you for free. Yes, you're welcome. Come into the CD a little bit closer. I don't want her to hear. I think video stores should start creating a special couples cut section. And I'm not talking about the black curtain hanging in the back corner of the store. You know, the ones that are just thick enough to block the view inside and let you walk by really fast so the breeze pushes it to the side slightly, thereby offering you a brief but tantalizing look at both the goods and, paradoxically, the bearded men in trench coats renting them. No, I'm talking about an entirely new concept. All of the DVDs in this new couples cut section would feature Bonnet movies. Bonnets, 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 bonnets are everywhere, but here's the trick. 15 minutes in, which is about 5 minutes after she's fallen asleep, the movie quietly goes to black. After about a minute of darkness, which is your safety net in case she awakens, damn this broken DVD, a new movie starts, and there's not a bonnet to be found. No, no, no. This movie has fast cars, spaceships, ninjas, preferably all three. Yeah, a good old-fashioned laser movie. Think about it. You could finally rent a room with a view to a kill. You win, she wins, but most of all, you win. Now, the whole key to this plan working is that women must never know about the existence of this section of the video store. Therefore, we need a universal indicator for men to tell quickly if it's a couples cut movie, something that seems innocuous to the uninformed, her, while standing out to the enlightened, us. You know what? I think I have just the idea. The man sign should be a made-up actress's name, like Emma Winslet, you know, right there listed on the DVD. If you see the name Emma Winslet printed on the back, forget about what's on the front, because you're only enduring 15 minutes of it. Genius! Yes! Yes, I know. Together we can save mankind. Now, go out and treat that wife of yours to a movie starring Emma Winslet. Section 8. Media bias. What? It exists? I'm sorry. 39 years, 3 words, 8 days. Done. Don Imus had insulted every group of people in every context imaginable for 4 straight decades. He had been paid millions of dollars to do it. But when he called the Rutgers women's basketball team nappy-headed hoes, he broke the unwritten rule. Don't be controversial during a slow news cycle, even if your contract mandates that you do. ADD moment here. Am I the only one that noticed that the term nappy-headed was followed by the word hose? The news media was always focused on the racial part of the statement because it made for the best tabloid headlines, but you'd think that basically calling college students disease-riddled streetwalkers who sell their bodies for money would be a little more of an insult than crudely describing their hairstyle. It was a bizarre 8 days. Person after person went on television to say how strong the Rutgers women were, and yet how devastated they must be by the 3 words uttered by an 825-year-old talk show host almost nobody ever listened to live. In reality, I miskicked the proverbial cute little puppy. The Rutgers women's basketball story was a heartwarming one. They weren't anybody's enemy, and people were upset that some rich white guy would tear down their moment of second-place glory. But the legitimate annoyance at his comments turned into a roadmap of how to gain power and control. In the end, Imus learned that no matter how many Democrats he endorsed, no matter how many sick African-American kids he helped, the second that calling him a racist would help people obtain power, he was a racist. During Don Imus's interview on Al Sharpton's radio show 5 days after the comment, Sharpton said, "The question is not whether you're a rabid racist with intent. If you commit a crime, intent may be an element, but the crime is still there." Well, first of all, let's remember that no criminal event occurred here. And even if there was, intent still plays a major role in determining punishment. That's why you can be charged with first, second, and third degree murder, along with manslaughter. But when it comes to racist words, it's all about intent. After all, if it was just about the actual words, then wasn't Sharpton also a racist for repeating the phrase, nappy-headed hoes? No, because we assume Sharpton's intent wasn't to slur his own people. Isn't it frightening that a man could be fired based solely on pressure groups and their best guess at his intent? Especially when the evidence is approximately 5 seconds of a 39-year career. Lost in the debate and the shock over how quickly it all happened was how ridiculous our priorities have become. Both MSNBC and CBS Radio decided to fire Imus before or during his annual telethon, which routinely raises millions of dollars for children's charities. Couldn't they have waited a couple more days? Do they really believe that off-color language by a radio host demands priority over curing childhood cancer and sudden infant death syndrome? As the circus escalated, those who were thrilled to appear on Imus's show to sell their book or promote their candidacy just a few days before took turns retroactively elevating themselves to the high road. But that was basically just the human survival instinct kicking in. The bigger problem was the media themselves. The Imus story revealed massive holes in our media landscape that show no sign of closing anytime soon. Mm-mm. Here are just a few of the incredible errors and unbelievably misleading reports that surrounded the demise of Don Imus's career. Time's cover story on the controversy theorized that one of Imus's problems was that while, quote, Howard Stern may be offensive, he's also self-deprecating, making fun of his own satirism, looks, and even manly endowment. Imus doesn't take it nearly as well as he dishes it out. His shtick is all cowboy-hatted swagger. Had anyone at Time ever listened to Imus? His show is almost entirely based on how ugly, old, crotchety, and miserable he was. The Time story about Imus included a series of racially charged quotes from different public figures that were assigned an outrage factor on a scale of 1 to 10. The higher the number, the more trouble it brought to the person who said it. The point was seemingly to highlight the fact that the line of who can say what is hard to understand. While that's true, the pattern they seem to miss is that you can apparently say a lot more if you're politically associated with the left than if you are with the right. Over and over again, Imus's commentary on Gwen Ifill, he supposedly called a black journalist a cleaning lady, was repeated as case-closing evidence that he had a long history of hate-filled comments. Did anybody even bother to look at the context of the Ifill remark? Imus explained it like this. We had a bit on the radio called Imus in Washington, which is fake news, and I had a fake David Duke character, and this David Duke-like character, reflecting the philosophy and the attitude of the Reagan administration, said, "Isn't it great that we got Gwen Ifill, who's been invited back to the White House as a cleaning lady?" And for years, people have said that I said that. I didn't say it. That was satire, a reflection of the racism we perceived of that administration. So not only was Imus not being racist, he was using a character to make the point that the Reagan administration was racist. An opinion that almost everybody who criticized Imus's Rutgers comments would have stood up and applauded. I would vehemently disagree. But the point is, if you criticize Imus for comments made in character, then you might as well call everybody who's ever played Hitler in a movie a genocidal anti-Semite. Right or wrong, shouldn't Imus's explanation have found its way into every story that used the Eiffel comments against him? It's not as if his defense was hard to find. He gave it in the middle of the now infamous Al Sharpton interview. It was even fully transcribed for easy access by the New York Times. The Los Angeles Times reported that Imus called the Conway and Whitman show on Los Angeles radio station KLSX and vowed, "I plan to be on the radio and plan to work again. I'm not going to sit around like an old woman." Brian Whitman, one of the show's co-hosts, is not only a good friend of mine of I don't know how many years, but he's also done a dead-on voice impersonation of Imus for years. Could Brian have actually fooled the Los Angeles Times? Yeah. A few days later, they apologized. In that Los Angeles Times non-apology sort of way, quote, "For the record, the comments were not made by Don Imus, but by the program's co-host, Brian Whitman, who is doing an impression of Imus. Imus was not a guest on the program." Well, I'll give the Los Angeles Times a little credit. At least they made an effort to correct it. How many others make similarly enormous mistakes and then just ignore them? Remember, these aren't small local papers or high school newsletters. These are major media organizations seemingly not even bothering to understand what they're reporting. "Oh, who cares if a couple of newspapers get their facts wrong? Everybody makes mistakes." True. But when it comes to the media, these mistakes become amplified over and over and over again by the process of ingestion. Oh, that sounds spooky. Believe me, Jack, it is. When you put a piece of news video or a report into the main computer systems, they say it's been ingested. It's like you're living in the frickin' Borg, man. That's a microcosm of the process that occurs with today's media and our wired world. Once something has been ingested as fact, it's infinitely repeated across the internet throughout the media until, right or wrong, it just simply becomes the truth. When Sheryl Crow wrote a blog about how we all need to do our part to stop global warming,
"Yeah, we should only use one square of toilet paper,"
dozens of credible newspapers reported on it. When I saw those reports, I assumed that they had done their homework. I repeated the story on my radio and television shows. Later that evening, I read the full blog entry myself and realized, taken in context, her toilet paper comment was clearly a joke. I took full responsibility for my part in repeating that story. Quite honestly, when I first read the story, I just assumed that she was really that ignorant about global warming. I didn't question the media or do my own homework. I allowed myself to be influenced by the cartoon version of liberal entertainers that I had in my own mind. While that vision is built on a long line of their incontrovertible stupidity, it's just not fair to apply it to every instance of every entertainer promoting a liberal cause. The next day, I corrected the story, both on TV and radio, but most of the other sources that reported it didn't bother, they just moved on. Later, Crow thanked me for correcting the story. Oh, she knows my name. Even though she surely still thinks I'm completely insane about global warming, a feeling that is obviously reciprocated. I understand this is a small, inconsequential example. Obviously, it's not exactly vital to national security if we think Sheryl Crow is slightly crazier now than we did before, but regardless of what side of the argument you're on, the truth does matter, doesn't it? Admittedly, I'm probably a little more sensitive than the average person when it comes to words being misused to fit an agenda. There is literally an entire industry now set up through big-name Democratic financiers to force me and others, with a conservative point of view, off the air. I believe this is a sign of liberal talk radio surrender. Since those shows and networks couldn't win in the marketplace, they've resorted to slanderous calls of racism and bigotry by taking words out of context. Here are just a few of my favorite examples. Glenn Beck says Katrina victims are scumbags. You know what? Let me tell you something. I say a lot of stupid things, but this was not one of them. Unfortunately, that hasn't stopped it from being used by those who either want to intentionally lie to the public to further their own agendas, or those who haven't spent more than 30 seconds researching it. While the insinuation that I hated people suffering from the worst natural disaster in our country's history makes for a nice little headline, the facts are just laughable. First, what most people quote, including journalist Keith Olbermann, is a grand total of one word out of a 20-minute monologue. Second, the topic of the monologue that morning was the fact that many people had started to get Katrina fatigue. The news was littered with reports of people shooting at rescue helicopters and children's hospitals, and videos of looters stealing flat-screen televisions. I specifically pardoned anyone looting essential supplies throughout the week. I used the monologue as a plea for Americans to ignore these people, to look past the looters, to look past the murderers, or more accurately, the scumbags, to the real victims, and dig deep and help. Why did I say dig deep? Because that morning, I was broadcasting from a parking lot of a restaurant as part of our fundraiser for Katrina survivors. People could pull up and make their donations right there from their car windows on the way to work. All told, we raised more than $160,000 for Katrina survivors. If I really thought these people were scumbags, I doubt I would have really bothered. Third, remember the whole context matters discussion? If these people had bothered to listen to the rest of the monologue, they would have heard me say I was only referring to, and I quote, myself, a small percentage of 0.2% of the survivors. That means I had expressed somewhere in the area of a 99.98% approval rating of Katrina survivors. Fourth, I was also ripped for saying in the same monologue that I was annoyed at around 10 of the families of the more than 3,000 9/11 victims because I felt Americans had given until it hurt, and a few families seemed to be using their tragic position and America's sorrow for political and/or financial gain. Essentially, I was criticized for having a 99.7% approval rating of 9/11 families. If you can name any group of people, including your own family, and honestly tell me that you approve of at least 99.7% of their actions, I'll be happy to call you a liar. There was at least one positive that came out of this whole mess. The few people who did bother to actually look into the details realized two important things. One, I'm not the personification of evil on Earth. And two, those who reported these quotes outside their original context have absolutely zero credibility. Here's the next one. Glenn Beck wants to nuke the world. Yeah, that's me. This has got to be one of my personal favorites, because it's a great example of how those who don't like your politics will sell their soul to the 14th level of hell just to destroy your career. For some reason, we were talking about American Idol that day, and one of my producers, I believe it was Stu, began playing a horrible Clay Aiken song. Reacting to the overwhelming femininity of the moment, I told him to give me something butch to talk about. He said, "How about blowing up Iran?" So, in my gruff, stereotypical alpha male character voice, you know, this one, I said, "I say we nuke the bastards." Reasonably intelligent people without an agenda, might say that I wasn't making a serious policy statement.
Oh, yes, he was. He wanted to nuke the bastards.
Considering it was done in a character voice over a crappy Clay Aiken song. But that didn't stop blog after blog from reporting it as if I were serious. In fact, the very next thing I said was, in fact,
it doesn't have to be Iran. It could be everywhere, any place that disagrees with me.
Did anyone really think that I was advocating the nuclear annihilation of every country on the planet, including my own, that doesn't agree with everything I say? Of course not. They just knew that people who read blogs wouldn't bother looking into it any further. They have that low of an opinion of their readership. And, my gosh, sadly enough, it's pretty accurate. And then, of course, there is the infamous Glenn Beck insults Muslim congressman. Here it is, the most poorly worded question of all time. I said, quote, "You are saying, let's cut and run. And I have to tell you, I've been nervous about this interview with you because what I feel like saying to you is, sir, prove to me that you're not working with our enemies." That's what I asked Keith Ellison, the first Muslim ever elected to Congress in America. To his credit, Ellison has never attempted to exploit my flub, but others have happily stepped in for him. But before I get much further into this, let's first back up and start with the basics. To believe that I'm some evil hate monger who thinks that Ellison is a terrorist and that all Islam is evil, you have to ignore a lot of contradictory evidence. For example, you first have to believe that I was only telling the truth when I butchered that one question, and I was lying when I made each of these other statements in the same interview. Beck, what I feel like saying is, sir, prove to me that you're not working with our enemies, and I know you're not. That part always seems to get left out in the media. Beck, I'm not accusing you of being an enemy. Ellison, I don't need to prove my patriotic stripes. Beck, and I'm not asking you to. Beck, I really don't believe that Islam is a religion of evil. I think it's being hijacked, quite frankly. Beck, you come from a district that is heavily immigrant with Somalians, and I think that's wonderful, honestly. Beck, you could be an icon to show Europe this is the way you integrate into a country. Beck, I think the Somalians coming out and voting is a very good thing. Ellison, if you were to gather Muslims up and ask them how they feel about this country, they'll talk about it being the land of opportunity, the place where they can worship their faith as they choose, a place where they can earn a decent living. Beck, yes, I agree with you. We don't have any argument there. If you can jump through the hoops of believing that the enemy question was the only honest thing I said in the whole interview, and, of course, ignore hundreds of other times I've talked about Islam as a religion of peace, then you probably already have your mind made up, so feel free to skip ahead and further dodge the truth. Many Americans, including me, have asked the question, where are the voices of Muslims standing up against terrorism and the people who have perverted their religion? On my radio and television shows, we've now gone farther than just asking the questions. We give the answers. We've gone out and found dedicated, practicing American Muslims who are standing up, and I've given those voices the amplification they need to be heard. That's why we spent almost half of our special on Islamic extremism highlighting the voices of reason in both the United States and the Middle East. But until those voices are heard with regularity, it's natural for people to have questions. And who better to answer them than the first Muslim congressman? ADD moment. On the bright side, this controversy finally put to rest one long-standing argument. Who's funnier, Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert? Both shows did bits wrecking me for my awfully worded question. Jon Stewart's take was brutal but brilliantly funny. And Stephen Colbert's bit? Not so much. Glad I could help, America, answer that one question. How about this one? Glenn Beck says something else about Muslims. Let me actually start with the quote. Muslims need to start saying, quote, hey, you know what? There are good Muslims and bad Muslims, and we need to be the first ones in the recruitment office lining up to shoot the bad Muslims in the head. I guess I can clarify one thing in case you're confused. In this context, bad Muslims doesn't refer to Muslims getting caught stealing Baby Ruth bars at a 7-Eleven. It refers to Islamic extremists who are plotting to blow up really tall buildings and kill lots of innocent people. With that said, let me be clear. Like Japanese Americans who fought harder than anyone in World War II, good Muslims should be the first in line to shoot bad Muslims in the head, period. Glenn Beck calls Jimmy Carter a waste of skin. Now, this one's just plain accurate. So, what does all of this tell us? I mean, who cares if some overweight but still oddly sexy, yeah, oh yeah, your wife knows it, radio and TV host is unfairly treated, right? You should care, and here's why. While there has always been completely partisan organizations funded by political opponents to spread disinformation, the access and credibility these organizations now have with the mainstream media are unprecedented, thanks in part to the McCain-Feingold Act. Yeah, and the fancy campaign finance reform, I love that. The media also have fewer and fewer resources to do their own homework these days. And the result is that many journalists turn to these hackish blogs and political action groups as real sources, or, in Keith Olbermann's case, his only source. Allegedly. I mean, I read that on a blog. When those with obvious agendas and horrible track records for honesty and accuracy are treated as if they're seasoned nonpartisan reporters, you'll wind up not being able to trust the news at all. And unfortunately, I fear that's exactly where we're headed. My solution? Attention John McCain and Russ Feingold. There is no way to stop people from exaggerating, twisting the facts, and making stuff up when political gain is on the line. George Soros and people of his awful ilk have enough money to promote lies about their political enemies and turn them into racist, bigoted hate mongers. There's just no way to stop the spread of information, even if it's completely false outside of totalitarianism, which still isn't working in China, even when assisted by Google. By the way, thanks, guys. Good move. The only way to solve the snowballing falsehoods of today's media landscape is to do some reporting of your own. You have to keep a little mental record of who's telling you the stories that check out and who's spinning them for their own purposes. Then, when you catch somebody stretching the truth beyond recognition, you need to hold them responsible by calling them out and just going someplace else. We already do this to some degree. For example, conservatives have always been skeptical of what they hear from the mainstream media. So when Dan Rather started reporting memos about George W. Bush's military record that were basically sketched with crayon on a napkin by the credibility equivalent of the head of the DNC, no conservative was surprised that, what? It didn't check out? But as the internet continues to foster the spread of lies and misleading commentaries faster than a computer virus promising nude pictures of Jessica Alba, we all have to be more vigilant. Aside from outright lies and distortion, the media are also developing a problem with being completely honest about the prism they're presenting the news through. That's what I don't understand about people like Keith Olbermann. It's not as if people don't know he's a liberal. It's obvious, just as obvious as I like pastries. So why not just admit it? It's not a dirty word, or is it? Are you ashamed to say I see most things from a liberal point of view? So when I tell you this next story about Karl Rove and Dick Cheney murdering little puppies, keep that in mind? After all, Olbermann provides a cute little service every night with his one-hour review of the day's liberal blog entries. Why even bother acting like you're a real journalist? I'm not a journalist, but you don't have to be Bob Woodward to figure that out. Just because I'm on a news network doesn't mean I'm a news person. My goal is to digest what actual journalists report and give you my opinion on it. An opinion that is proudly and openly from a conservative point of view. You know that right up front, and you can do with it what you want. I think America appreciates that level of honesty. Unfortunately, people like Keith Olbermann apparently do not. Section 9. Child Molesters. It was a moment without politics. Despite the fact that Barack Obama was running for president and threatening to implement the exact opposite of every policy that conservatives believe would help the country, nobody cared. Those who heard what happened were immediately transformed from Democrats and Republicans into moms and dads. A website run by an admitted pedophile had posted pictures of Obama's children. Next to each child was the rating of their cuteness. ADD moment here. This site goes on to compare the struggle of the girl lover to the emancipation of slaves and the fight for civil rights for minorities. I'm sure the most credible black presidential candidate in American history really appreciated that comparison. Perhaps even more horrifying, though, was the section of the site called Sugar and Spice. Designed in pink and blue pastels, it looked, quite honestly, as if it could have easily been the My Little Pony website. There was no doubt about the target audience, little girls. Sugar and Spice featured an area called Touching, which included this message to young girls written in purple text. Quote, "You have to start being careful when you start kissing your special friend. While a quick kiss is almost always okay, if you start French kissing your special friend, some people might try to punish your friend. This is because they interpret the law in a way that only suits them." It went on to tell girls how not to worry because there are no laws against hugging. Snuggling with each other on the couch is also okay. Snuggling on the couch? Am I the only father who would have a very tough time not taking advantage of the Second Amendment if somebody told my daughter that? It gets worse. This predator realized the final step of breaking down an innocent child's last line of defense is discrediting us, the parents. He wrote, "You may have learned about good touching and bad touching. Probably you've been told that touching in the private parts of your body is bad touching. This isn't always the case." That really puts partisan political differences into perspective, doesn't it? When Obama's lawyers got wind of this sickening website, they sent this monster a letter. He mercifully removed the photos, but remained indignant on several other requests. The Sugar and Spice and Touching sections of the website remain online. It's natural for all of us to hope that this sort of thing is an isolated incident, the work of one deranged man who acts out his repulsive fantasies online. After all, the website was hosted in Panama, and the target was a very visible national figure. Something like that could never happen to my kids, right? Puyallup, Bellingham, Bellevue, Skagit County, even my Mount Vernon. Those names might not mean anything to you, but they mean a lot to me. They're all areas I remember from my childhood. They're places that my parents brought me to celebrate holidays, go to the Puyallup Fair every summer. My grandparents lived in Puyallup. We went shopping in these cities. I grew up in Skagit County. They also were among the areas that popped up on the website of 45-year-old, unemployed, living with his parents, admitted pedophile, Jack McClellan. What he did with his spare time, which apparently he had a lot of, was visit different area events such as school plays, skating rinks, carnivals, even Easter egg hunts, and write reviews about which ones provided the best access to LGs. If you weren't in the middle of a section about child molesters, you'd probably never believe it, but LGs means little girls in the pedophile dictionary. McClellan's website, the self-anointed premier site of the girl love revolution, states that its primary purpose is to promote association, friendship, and legal, non-sexual, consensual touch, hugging, cuddling, etc., between men and prepubescent girls. Sure it is. Sure it is. I wonder, given how legal the whole thing is, why McClellan posted the jail time and fines for each offense that one might run into as a perfectly legal girl lover. For example, there's communication with a minor for immoral purposes. 0 to 1 year in prison, $0 to $5,000 fine. Luring, $0 to 5 years, $0 to $10,000 fine. Child molestation in the first degree, $0 to life, $0 to $50,000 fine. And of course, everyone's personal favorite, the rape of a child in the first degree, $0 to life, $0 to $50,000. McClellan's website reads like a pedophilia nightlife guide, highlighting the best places and the times to stalk young girls. Public libraries. You can get quite close to LGs there. They've sat next to me at the internet terminals. Elementary schools. I've been surprised at how close you can get to some, and how long you can loiter there without being noticed. If the kids aren't out on the playground, the next recess will probably be in less than 2 hours. Nude beaches. An email correspondent said, there are sometimes nude children here. Halloween. This is the one day of the year when LGs might come to your place. Tutoring programs. I've thought about trying to get into a program like this, including volunteering for Girl Scouts. But I believe they're on high alert for pedophiles. I'd probably be out of there the first time I tried to hug an LG. Big brothers, big sisters. An email correspondent recommended mentoring programs. I think big brothers and big sisters have them, where you get to pick up the child and take him on outings on a one-on-one basis. But he also said that they usually pair the adult with a child of the same sex. The site even featured a section titled International Cities, where unsupervised girls can be found on the streets. Included was this profile of Buenos Aires. I saw a number of panhandling LGs. I talked with and cuddled several without any problems from the cops. Like a stereotypically bad movie, the entry closed with a picture of one of those young girls, holding the pudding and coins that the pedophile had given her. Have we talked about the Second Amendment yet? Whether it's a location in the area of Build-A-Bear workshops or reacting to a missing 10-year-old girl by writing, "She's cuter than she appears in the FBI poster," there's an incredible amount of shocking material on McClellan's site. But what may almost be as disturbing is what the police said when the story of this website came out. They knew all about it, but they couldn't do anything. As illogical as that may sound, the reason was that there was no real proof of any illegal activity. Despite everyone's deep suspicion that McClellan would commit a crime and that the site he ran almost definitely inspired others to commit crimes, they couldn't prove it. This isn't, after all, a Minority Report type of world where you can arrest people based on future acts. Therefore, Jack McClellan, an admitted pedophile, was able to talk publicly about his erotic arousal by girls ages 4 to 11 without any fear of reprisal, while the parents who lived in my hometown, the town I grew up in as a kid, felt as though their families were literally being held hostage. After a media firestorm, the website's hosting company finally shut it down. Yet, less than 3 months later, McClellan back online with a similar site, this time based in Los Angeles. Some of you may be wondering why we can't just arrest him if he's admitted on camera that he's a pedophile. That's because